Hello, Dreamers, and welcome to this 257th episode of California Dreaming. Before we get started, I have a few notes about the show. This is an independent one-woman production, which means I depend on you, the listeners, to keep this thing going and growing, and there are a few ways that you can help. You can leave a nice rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you use to listen. It gives us more visibility and helps new listeners find us. You could recommend us to your friends on social media or in true crime fan forums. And if you would like to help the show and gain access to more exclusive content, you can join Patreon. Starting at just $1 a month, you will be able to listen to dozens of full-length episodes you won't hear anywhere else. They're exactly the same style and format as the regular show, and every patron gets to listen whichever tier you choose. And if you would like to make a one-time donation, you can do so through PayPal using the email californiapod@gmail.com. This week, I'd like to thank Jans, Javier, Marie W., Stacia A., Trisha P., Sam G., Vicky C., Sylvia D., and Jane G. for either joining Patreon, raising their pledge, coming back, or donating through PayPal. All right, let's get started with today's episode. While it happens every once in a while, it's not really all that common for people to commit murder or try to commit murders together. And when we do come across cases where two people get together to conspire to kill someone or some people, it's often couples who are in an intimate long-term relationship. It's like usually one of them has this weird desire or fetish and the other one goes along to satisfy their needs. So when I decided to cover this case for you today, I thought back on the last almost 6 years of this show to see how many times we've talked about a story where people teamed up to do crimes. And I found more than I thought I would in our back catalog. The very first one where we had two people team up to commit a crime was all the way back in episode 13 with those two men who planned the 1997 North Hollywood Bank of America robbery and shootout. And while the plan initially was to pull off a bank robbery, these two guys were clearly armed to kill if they needed to in order to make their getaway. The very next case where people got together to conspire to kill that we covered was when Skylar De Leon recruited a couple of people to go along with him and help him rob Tom and Jackie Hawks. You guys remember that case? They had met with the Hawks under the guise that Skylar was going to purchase their boat, but the intention was to force them to sign over ownership of the boat, throw the couple overboard, and steal it from them. Skylar's girlfriend or wife at the time was also in on the plot, but she wasn't actually there at the time those killings took place out at sea. However, she ended up refusing to take a deal with prosecutors and decided to try and roll the dice on a trial instead of rolling over on Skylar, the love of her life apparently, and she ended up in prison for the rest of her life, too. I did another story not too long after that, out of the state of Florida, involving several people being killed on a boat, a plan that was orchestrated by a man named Kirby Archer. He also recruited a few other people to help him as well. The next couple that I discussed that committed a murder together was 14-year-old Tyler Witt and her boyfriend. They conspired to kill Tyler's mom because she disapproved of their relationship. And there was another similar story out of Orange County that we talked about not too long after that episode involving another young woman named Rachel Mullinex and her boyfriend. It was the same deal. She and her boyfriend killed her mom because she too disapproved of their relationship. We talked about that couple out of Paris, California, David and Louise Turpin, and how they kept their 13 children held captive in horrible conditions until one of those children finally escaped and managed to get them all help. We also cover the case of Jesse James Hollywood, where he and some of his friends conspired to kill a young man named Nick Markowitz because Nick's older half-brother owed Jesse James some money. We talked about the murder of Gwen Arahu, who was killed by a group of friends who were angry when they discovered that she was transgender. And there was a similar situation with the case we covered last summer with Brandon Tina. A group of friends once again murdered him when they figured out that he was transgender as well. We also covered the case of mother and son duo Sante and Kenneth Kimes. They conspired to kill a couple of people together for financial gain. In a more recent case, we talked about Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell, accused of conspiring to kill her two children, Tylee Ryan and JJ Vallow, and possibly even more people for financial gain. We also talked about the murder of Jared Davidson. His former in-laws conspired to murder him over custody of his daughter, who was their granddaughter. The closest thing that we have had to the kind of killers that we're going to be talking about today that we've discussed on our show in the past is probably Sante and Kenneth Kimes, that mother and son who were basically well on their way to becoming serial killers. They were going along and killing people across a period of time for financial gain. Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell were another. And I think that we find it to be more common when we think about killer couples. They're in, like I said, a romantic relationship. The two of them, Vallow and Daybell, they did what they did for financial gain. And there are those couples who get off on killing together just to kill together, it seems like. Like Carla Homolka and Paul Bernardo, Myra Hindley and Ian Bradley, Deborah Brown and Alton Coleman, David Ray Parker and Cindy Hendy, Fred and Rosemary West. You all know what I'm talking about. They do this together just because they get some sort of weird, sick, sadistic pleasure out of doing it together. And I just kind of noticed that I really don't venture into those types of cases that I just mentioned. These really evil couples who get together and they kidnap, rape, torture, and murder their victims. And it gives them this weird sexual thrill in their relationship. And there just tend to be certain types of stories that I shy away from. And sadistic serial killer couples are typically ones that I avoid. I'm not opposed to doing it. I guess I just kind of lean away from it. And even today, the story that we're going to talk about is purely financial gain. But the interesting thing about these ladies is that they were friends. Well, sort of friends. Frenemies, maybe. Who were older. They were retired. They may or may not have been collecting pensions. I don't know what kind of lives these ladies lived before they started becoming partners in crime. And they were going around targeting vulnerable older men. And what stood out the most about these two was their age. Keith Morrison, our favorite Dateline voice ever, he told their story in his multi-part series called The Thing About Helen and Olga a couple of years back. And I was going to tell you about them today in a one-off episode, but it's kind of turned into two because it was getting kind of long. So this is the first part of a two-part series, and this is the 257th episode of California Dreaming, The Tale of the Golden Girls Gone Wild. In an alleyway located along Brea Boulevard in Hollywood, California, on the morning of November 8, 1999, the body of a man was discovered by a passerby who then called 911. The LAPD responded to the location, but in an initial search of this man's pockets, they were unable to find any form of identification. So for the time being, they were dealing with a John Doe who appeared to be an older white man, and they believed him to be homeless. In addition to not knowing who this man was, they also really couldn't tell right away with what they were dealing with here. If this was some kind of accident, or if he was killed and dumped here at this location. But once the crime scene analysts had a chance to examine the location and the man's body, based on what they found, they concluded that the man had been run over by a vehicle. The man's clothing had oil or grease stains, and he suffered injuries consistent with what is referred to as road rash, meaning that when he was struck by that vehicle, he was dragged for a distance underneath it, causing abrasions on his skin from the pavement. The man's body had been there for a while. He hadn't been discovered until the morning, which led investigators to believe that there were no witnesses beyond the person who ran this man over, and that person apparently fled the scene making this a hit and run. And there were no surveillance cameras on any of the buildings adjacent to that alley that may have captured this hit and run. So from the start, things were looking pretty bleak, considering investigators didn't even know who this man was. Once the medical examiner conducted an autopsy on this man's body, it was determined at the time that he was struck by the vehicle, he had actually been laying down on the ground. He wasn't standing up or moving around. So it's not uncommon for homeless people to sleep in alleyways, but what was unusual about this was the fact that the man's body was found in the middle of the alley. Nobody does that for obvious reasons. Chances are, if you lay down and fall asleep in the middle of an alley, then you're gonna get run over. Unless the man was under the influence, if he had been drinking or using drugs, then it's possible that he passed out inadvertently in the middle of the alley rather than off to the side and someone driving through simply didn't see him. But when the man's toxicology reports came back, he was found to have had absolutely nothing in his system. At the time of his death, this man was stone cold sober. So that eliminated the possibility of him having passed out because of drugs or alcohol. The question they were able to answer through autopsy was when they took his fingerprints and entered them into APHIS, they found him to be in the system by way of the Department of Justice from an incident in his past that occurred up in Sacramento, California. And through that, they found out his name was Paul Vados. And at the time of his death, he was 73 years old. Originally from Hungary, he had immigrated to the United States and settled in California. After losing his wife, Paul sank into a deep depression. He battled loneliness and alcoholism and wound up living on the streets. Just before Paul was officially identified through his fingerprints, two older women showed up at the LAPD's Wilshire District Station. They were there to file a missing persons report. They were 67-year-old Olga Rutterschmidt and 69-year-old Helen Golay. Both of these ladies were very well put together, nicely dressed, finely groomed. They were two very sophisticated ladies. But they were there because they were extremely worried. Helen explained that she was engaged to a gentleman named Paul Vados, and the other woman who was with her, Olga, said that she was a relative of his, and both of them had immigrated from Hungary. They had been out of touch for a few years and were finally able to reunite there in California. Helen and Olga explained that Paul had been staying with them, they'd been helping to take care of him, that his health was not good, he was not in good shape, and a few days ago he had gone missing and they became very worried since they hadn't heard from him. The police, you know, eventually put it together and they were able to let these two ladies know that Paul had been brought in a few days earlier and that he had apparently been killed in a hit-and-run car accident. So once the women were able to recover from the initial shock of finding out that Paul had tragically died, they were then able to claim his body from the coroner's office. They were his next of kin, so they said, explaining that he had no other family, no children, no relatives, that they were all that he had. And in short order, they claimed Paul and quickly had him buried in an unmarked grave. So now fast forward a little more than 5.5 years later. The date is June 22nd, 2005. The LAPD received a 911 call about a body being discovered in an alleyway, this time off of Westwood Boulevard in West Los Angeles. And this would be approximately 7 miles away from the location where Paul's body was found back in 1999. This time, the deceased man had some identification on him, but it was kind of odd because the ID cards that he had appeared to be homemade and laminated. And these handmade cards stated that his name was Kenneth McDavid and that he was 50 years old. Kenneth was the middle of five siblings. He was a music lover, who found work as a DJ when he was in college, and he would continue to work as a DJ in both the San Francisco and Sacramento areas. Growing up, Kenneth's parents both worked full-time, and he was the one who would basically take care of his four other siblings, the younger ones and the older ones. He cooked the meals, he watched over the little ones, he was just really the caregiver of the bunch. That was his role in the family. When he started working in the radio DJ business, Kenneth had this tendency to not really stay at a job for a very long period of time. He went from gig to gig, and he was described as just being the type of person who had a hard time staying put in one place. Keeping his focus on one thing for an extended period of time was difficult for him. In the decade or so before his death, Kenneth had fallen out of touch with his family and eventually found himself without a job and without a home. One of his sisters, who has spoken openly about this, would later say that Kenneth was a very sensitive soul, and what was most likely going on with him is he didn't want to be a burden on any of his siblings, as none of them ever knew that he was homeless. An autopsy was conducted on Kenneth, and it was determined that he suffered from some serious blunt force trauma to his upper body, crushed ribs, his chest was crushed, his spine was fractured, and he had some road rash injuries, consistent again with having been dragged underneath a vehicle. His injuries were indicative of having been hit by a car, but at a rather slow speed. Also, the toxicology report revealed that in his system, he had alcohol, zolpidem, which is Ambien, and topiramate, which is a seizure medication, and hydrocodone. So this man was basically knocked out cold with the alcohol, prescription sleep aid, and other powerful drugs. One strange thing about Kenneth's death was the fact that in addition to having all that blunt force trauma to his body, his head had also been crushed, but his eyeglasses, which were found near his body, were in perfect condition. However, with all of those substances in his system, the first thought was that he had passed out in the middle of the alleyway and then was hit by a car on accident. This time, however, there were surveillance cameras in the alleyway that actually captured what happened. Well, some of it anyway. Investigators pored over the footage that they retrieved from these cameras, and it was during the night before Kenneth's body was found that they saw something unusual going on with a vehicle that drove through this alley. Now, this was 2005, and it was nighttime. And I think this is just about one of the most grainiest, worst videos I've ever watched in terms of surveillance videos. And upon initial review, all you can really see are the strange movements of a vehicle. During the night, a car had turned into the alleyway off of Westwood Boulevard and Ohio Avenue. The car then traveled down the alley for a short distance, moving away from the surveillance cameras at a rather slow speed. You can't see the car, you can't see the license plates, you cannot see the person driving it. All you can see is the glow of the taillights. So the car then comes to a stop and the driver turns its lights off. And during the time the lights on this vehicle are off, you can't see anything going on in or around the car. In fact, you can't even really see the car anymore since the lights were no longer on. After a few minutes, the lights are turned back on and the car is started again. Then the car goes in reverse and then it moves forward and then it continues to drive down the alley away from the cameras. So the investigators were pretty convinced that whatever this car was doing, it had something to do with Kenneth McDavid's body ending up crushed in that alleyway. Remember, he had injuries consistent with being impacted by a slow-moving vehicle, and that is exactly what they were seeing there with this car captured on surveillance. Investigators decided to try and have those images on the video enhanced to see if they could possibly get more details related to the vehicle itself. After the video was enhanced, the analysts were able to determine that the vehicle was either a Ford Taurus or a Mercury Sable station wagon. Remember, for quite some time, and I believe they still do it, car manufacturers still do it to an extent, but what they try to do is they tailor details about vehicles to whomever their target consumer is, but these various automakers will use the same exact car for their specific make and model. For example, there was a time when the GMC Yukon, the Chevy Tahoe, and the Cadillac Escalade were all basically the same car. But you know, there will be the customer who hates Chevys or the customer who has to drive the luxury vehicle. So they'll take the same body and engine components, but call one a Cadillac and the other one a GMC, and you've catered to a different set of clientele with pretty much the exact same SUV. But anyway, analysts were able to determine that the vehicle acting weird in the alley was either a Ford Taurus or a Mercury Sable. And what stood out about those cars is that they had this unique oval-ish shaped back window, as well as distinctive shapes to the windows on the cargo area of the station wagon. And that's how they were able to identify the make and model of this car. So while they were working on figuring out the type of vehicle captured on the surveillance, other detectives canvassed the areas around the location where Kenneth's body was found, and they did so by knocking on doors and going into businesses to see if there was anyone who saw anything. And just like in Paul's case, the investigators came up empty. Nobody saw a thing. There were no other useful clues that provided any leads, and before long, the investigation into Kenneth's death went cold. So fast forward again about 7 months after Kenneth McDavid was found dead in that alleyway, towards the beginning of 2006. An insurance company claims investigator contacted the Los Angeles Police Department asking for copies of their files on Kenneth McDavid. The insurance investigator said that two women, Helen Golay and Olga Rederschmidt, these two older women, had filed a claim or a couple of claims on Kenneth's life insurance policies. Several policies had been taken out in his name, and the two of them were listed as beneficiaries to the tune of, at least for this one company, $1 million. So this sent up a couple of red flags with the detectives who had been assigned to Kenneth's case. And as they started to talk about what might be going on here with Kenneth, they started to wonder what the involvement of these two ladies had been, Helen and Olga. Well, as these detectives were sitting around talking about this, another officer who wasn't working on Kenneth's case at all, he was just nearby and overheard what was being said. As he listened, he found that there was something very familiar with what these other detectives were talking about. A dead body in an alleyway, two old ladies, insurance claims, etc., etc. So this officer who's snooping on their conversation, he goes and he digs up Paul Vados' case from more than 5 years earlier. And sure enough, they've got nearly an identical case. They had similar manners of death with the same two older ladies. And by this time, Helen was 75 and Olga was 73. And these two were claiming to be the only next of kin of the decedent. They turned around and filed claims on a bunch of insurance policies that had been taken out on Kenneth's life. It was very strange that these two women would surface in both of these cases. But what was even more strange is that they really aren't your usual, average, everyday suspects. I mean, murder suspects, right? And these two ladies are in their 70s. Are they actually going around killing people? It's almost unheard of. But, you know, it was what it was, and that's what was being presented to these investigators. So, yeah, in very short order, their prime suspects in two murders was turning out to be these two little old ladies. The thing that raised the alarm bells for the insurance investigator was the fact that there were such hefty insurance policies that had been taken out on these two homeless men. Nowadays, I doubt there would be any insurance carrier that would be willing to sell $1 million or more policy on a homeless person, but back then, I guess they weren't checking up as much. So the various entities involved in these cases, the insurance carriers, the investigators on Kenneth's case, and those on Paul's case, got together and started to compare notes. After they realized that they were dealing with potentially two killer little old ladies, the case was turned over to the LAPD's homicide unit, and they enlisted the help of the FBI and the Department of Insurance. So, first things first, they started checking into Olga's and Helen's backgrounds. And considering that they were looking to tie these ladies to two murders, they really didn't find very much in the way of their criminal histories. Olga had one little thing on her record for shoplifting, and Helen had absolutely nothing, a totally clean criminal record. And at that point, that's all investigators knew about these two. So they had questions. Who were these little old ladies? Do they work? Where do they live? Who are they to these men? Who are they to each other? But instead of tipping these ladies off by hauling them in for questioning to try to find answers, the lead homicide detective on the case instead chose to place both of them under surveillance. And it was not easy at all to justify the use of these valuable police resources because essentially they wanted as many as a dozen, possibly up to 15 or more of their police officers taking turns in pairs, working around the clock just to follow two little old ladies. It was almost comical when this was asked of their commanding officers, but they were given the go-ahead to follow them around, so they were told they'd better come up with something good soon because they weren't going to be able to keep Helen and Olga on surveillance around the clock for very long. As the investigation into Helen and Olga meandered along, detectives came to discover that these two ladies, they had somewhat of an interesting yet circuitous relationship. They had known each other since sometime in the 1980s, and it would later become known that these weren't just two little old ladies. They were two little old con artist ladies who had been getting their swindle on for quite some time. But it wasn't anything close to murder that they'd ever been involved in, and they would be able to get away with it because, really, they looked like they could be your grandma. Helen was born in northern Texas in 1931. There is very little known about her family and her upbringing, but it was discovered that when she was a child, her father was killed in a car accident. It's not known what was going on with Helen's mother, but she was mainly raised by her maternal grandmother. However, after her father was killed, Helen was moved from Texas to Washington State, where she lived with a cousin. So you can see that her family was pretty disjointed. For whatever reasons, Helen had a hard time with her living situations within her family. She had been sent from one relative to another, until finally she ran out of relatives and had no other place to go and wound up in the foster care system, where she stayed until she finished high school. After Helen turned 18, she relocated to Southern California. She settled down, got married, and together they had two children. That marriage ended in divorce, and Helen subsequently remarried to a second husband. That marriage also ended in divorce, but produced a third child named Keisha. From there, Helen tried getting into the real estate business in order to support herself. She began purchasing apartment buildings and earning money from rentals. But during that period of time, in the 1980s going into the 1990s, rent control regulations were in place, so landlords were prohibited from raising rents, which caused apartments to fall into disrepair. And even if there were tenants in the apartment complexes, the rent wasn't enough income for Helen. So what she started to do was essentially patrol her various apartment complexes looking for violations so that she could find her tenants. So those living in the buildings that she owned were getting slapped with fines left and right for petty things, and Helen pretty much had them over a barrel. And if anyone protested, she would just threaten to sue them. Helen constantly threatened litigation against anybody and everybody if anyone refused to do what she wanted them to do. So yeah, Helen was pretty much a bully of a landlord who saw fining and suing her tenants to be a great way to earn easy money. As for Olga, she was born on the other side of the world in 1933 in a country that had been ravaged by World War I and was just a few years away from entering into World War II. It was a very difficult time for the citizens of Hungary, and in order to survive, you really had to have your wits about you, and you basically had to do what you had to do in order to make it each day, which meant you had to lie, cheat, steal, and manipulate. And that is basically how Olga was raised and how her sense of values and morals developed, starting at a very young, impressionable age. And these were traits that Olga would carry with her and utilize for basically her entire life. After getting married to a man who was also from Hungary, together they moved to the United States when Olga was 24 years old in 1957. And they settled in Hollywood, California. Olga and her husband would never have any children together, which is probably a good thing, since you all are likely familiar with the direction that the story is headed. But it was just about right away, as soon as the new neighbors from Hungary moved into the building that they found to live in Hollywood, that the other tenants learned right away that Olga was a woman who wasn't exactly dealing with the full deck. She garnered this reputation for being the apartment's resident crazy lady who often lost her cool about random, nonsensical stuff. Olga constantly complained that the building was too noisy, and she was constantly calling for maintenance and repair requests from the apartment's manager. She would come out into the hallway and just start ranting at anybody who had the unfortunate timing to be passing by her front door. And for work, well, Olga actually wasn't known to be one who really wanted to hold down a regular job, though she was licensed as an electrologist. When I learned this and discovered that Olga really didn't like to work, I just kind of pictured her sitting in her apartment performing electrolysis on her own unwanted body hair. I mean, why else would you learn to do electrolysis and not work on other people? I'm sure it isn't easy, and I looked it up because I was just curious, but it's not impossible to do electrolysis on yourself. But anyways, as you can see, even though these two ladies grew up on different sides of the world, they both had this shared, similar character feature of not really wanting to work very hard. By the time Helen and Olga became acquainted with one another in the 1980s, the two of them were in their 50s. And you know, usually these types of ladies who like to have the easy life often also like to have the good life, right? And the both of them spent a good deal of time trying to maintain their looks and their appearances. And as much as they had in common, the main difference between them was the fact that Helen was very much the stronger personality of the two. And that was apparent based on what I told you about her managerial style in running her apartment buildings and her rental properties. In their friendship, Helen would emerge as the leader. Olga had this aspect of her personality where she always exuded the sense of neediness and desperation, stemming from her childhood experiences back in Hungary. But it was the desire to make quick, easy money where Helen and Olga, these two little old ladies, met in the middle. So together, Helen and Olga made for quite the charming pair of sophisticated ladies. They just had this way about them. I mean, they had the ability to be charismatic and alluring on their own, but together it was like they were double the trouble. Helen had a very sweet side to her, with a Texas accent, which may not stand out in Texas, but in California to a Californian, sometimes we hear those accents and it's just like the cutest thing ever, especially to the opposite sex. And Helen knew how to work that. Pair that up with Olga's Hungarian accent, that's like Zsa Zsa, Gabor, and all of her sisters, right? Like I said, double the trouble. It was very easy for Helen and Olga to have the men swooning. They both had the ability to win men over very easily with their looks and their unique exotic ways of speaking, and they very much used that to their advantage. And one of Helen and Olga's favorite places to meet new people was at the local gym, which is where the two of them first met and became friends. From there, they decided to try and meet men at more high-end places. You know, they're living in Los Angeles, in the Hollywood area. While Hollywood itself is actually a pretty run-down city, the areas around Hollywood, once you get into the hills, you know, like Beverly Hills, Bel Air, Hollywood Hills, Brentwood, etc., there are people with money. And there are also a lot of nice hotels. So what Helen and Olga started doing was they would go to some of these really nice, luxurious hotels and pretend to be guests. They would get all dolled up and go to their best, most expensive restaurants that these hotels had to offer and try to meet men there. And their plan would work. They would meet these guys. Obviously, they had money. And however it was they went about it, Helen and Olga would end up stealing wallets, money, and credit cards from these guys. And most of the time, almost always actually, these men would be way too embarrassed to file a police report. So the amount of people Helen and Olga were able to rip off in this manner can really never be known. It's just known that this went on for years. But as I mentioned earlier, Helen doing these sort of petty crimes, which is effectively kind of like high-end pickpocketing, is not really the kind of money that she is used to making. Remember, she had once made a career out of suing people, and there is really much more money to be made doing that. The stuff she's doing here with Olga, fleecing men, this is small time. And Olga is very interested in following along and learning Helen's tricks and schemes. So they started finding people, places, and things and situations where they could just be able to start threatening litigation for whatever reason. And more often than not, to avoid all of the hassle and all of the trouble, people would just end up wanting to settle out of court. But here's the thing about being a member of a gym or going to these hotels. You have to pay money and pay monthly dues. In order to stay at nice hotels, you have to rent a room. So if Helen and Olga are meeting men at the gym or at the hotel, they're probably doing all right for themselves, these men are. And they might have a good job or at least access to some good money. And the same can be said for anyone who Olga and Helen went around threatening to file lawsuits against too. The thing was is that these women, they knew their targets, and there had to be some measure of wealth there for the taking. These men aren't really necessarily in a position to be always that easily taken advantage of by a couple of middle-aged broads, right? I mean, Helen and Olga may have been able to keep up their con game for a little while, but it was only going to get them so far. They soon decided that there was probably a way for the both of them to be able to meet some older guys, perhaps guys that were more down on their luck, that would be easily taken by a charming, sophisticated lady with an accent. There are ways for those types to be manipulated, used, and taken advantage of. And if Helen and Olga were willing to put in a little bit more work, they might be able to find something there for them to work with that might be quite lucrative. We've covered at least one older lady who took advantage of elderly men, and her name was Dorothea Puente. That's an episode that I need to redo. And I remember being really unhappy with the volume of the music that was playing in the background of that episode, but that was back when my estranged husband was still helping me with the editing stuff. Anyway, one of these days, I'll go back and redo some of those episodes that I'm not happy with at all. But anyway, Dorothea Puente was the grandma who moved men into her home, and then she ended up killing several of them and continued to collect on their Social Security benefits. So yeah, that's one way of doing it. And Helen and Olga were starting to think along those lines, but the idea that they had come up with would take a little bit more time, which both of them were willing to invest because the payoff would be worth it. So Helen and Olga began to come up with a new plan that involved that more vulnerable target that I talked about, an easier target, if you will, the type who needed help. Not these wealthy older men anymore. They were going to look for men who were destitute and living on the streets, indigent types. And by this time, Helen and Olga had been fleecing men, threatening lawsuits, and ripping people off for well over a decade. So they had their con game pretty much perfected. And, you know, over time, beauty tends to fade. And I wouldn't be surprised if their ability to attract wealthy men started to fade right along with it. And these ladies are getting into their 70s. They're reaching that age when they're just not going to want to do this forever. And they're not going to be able to attract men forever. They've got to start thinking about, I guess, a retirement plan, for lack of a better word. And that's a thing that's going to take at least a couple of big windfalls. And we all know very well by now that the biggest payout when it comes to a con involves a victim. And I mean, it involves a victim losing more than just their wallet. So in 1997, Helen and Olga had a spiritual awakening of sorts, if you will. They started going to church. But it wasn't necessarily because they found God or wanting to get closer to their higher power. They found there to be a certain demographic in which various churches in the Los Angeles area tended to cater to. Churches that would offer hot meals to homeless people. And they specifically found that the Hollywood Presbyterian Church had one of the biggest programs that served the ever-growing homeless community in the surrounding areas. Hundreds of people turned up for the free meals at the church that they offered every day. And the fact is, there are not nearly as many accommodations available for the tens of thousands of homeless people in Southern California. And so these places were always looking for help, donations, and volunteers. And one day, Helen and Olga showed up at the church and were introduced to the Reverend at the Hollywood Presbyterian. They said that they were visiting and they wanted to offer their help. And the Reverend right away welcomed the two of them. They were both very sweet and charming as always, very well put together. And I mean, what a better cover than being two nice little old ladies. The church welcomed them as volunteers, and before long, Helen and Olga became acquainted with a gentleman named Paul Vados. So Paul had been going to Hollywood Presbyterian since sometime in the mid-1990s. I told you a little bit about him in the beginning and how he ended up homeless. Like Olga, he was originally from Hungary. He was known to be a very nice and polite man who the volunteers at the church got to know well and were very fond of. And while Helen and Olga, under the guise of wanting to be volunteers at the church, also became acquainted with Paul. It wasn't very difficult at all for the two of them to gain the attention of a man who was also needing and wanting to enjoy the attention that he was getting from them. It was almost too easy for Helen and Olga to win men like Paul over. After all, they had been at it for years, meaning Helen and Olga. And Paul had been without this sort of attention from a woman for many years. And really, it would only take a few minutes of conversation for Helen and Olga to be able to get a man like Paul to open up. Before long, the two women would be able to make the determination as to whether or not Paul was in the right place in life, in a position to be exactly what they were looking for when it came to their next scheme. And the criteria they were looking for was an older man who didn't have too many family members around, or family that he wasn't in touch with, or a guy who wasn't originally from Southern California. And it was important that there weren't any family members that would be asking too many questions or poking around or trying to find out what Helen and Olga were up to. If family were to stick their noses into their business, then Helen and Olga would not be able to manipulate these men. they wouldn't be able to run their con game. At this time, Helen still had a number of rental properties. After getting to know Paul at the church, they offered to let him move into one of the vacant apartments in one of Helen's buildings, an offer that Paul readily accepted. And it was help that he really couldn't refuse. They were going to help Paul get off the street, give him shelter, buy him clothing, give him food. They even helped him to get medical attention if he needed it. These were offers nobody in Paul's position could refuse, especially from two really nice, really well put together older ladies. And actually, Paul felt like his luck had finally taken a turn for the better. For these ladies to come along and offer him all this help, and you know, there was this kind of kinship from the start, seeing as both he and Olga were from Hungary. Like it was fate. It was meant for their paths to cross there in the United States. Paul really did feel very, very fortunate to have found these ladies and for them to have all of this willingness to help him and to get him off the streets. Of course, you know and I know that we wouldn't be here talking about Helen and Olga if there wasn't a catch to what the two of them were doing. And this takes me back to something that my dad always told me. And I think I'd even brought it up recently in a group therapy session that I was in. And it's the fact that nobody ever does anything for nothing. And what Helen and Olga wanted to do was they wanted to take out a number of insurance policies on Paul's life. Now, I'm under the impression that Paul may not have been 100% clear on what all of this paperwork that Helen and Olga had that they wanted him to sign. And it seems like they just told him to sign his name, and whatever they told him to do, he just did. And he might have been willing to just sign whatever and not even read what he was signing, because he grew to trust these women and simply believed whatever it was that they told him the paperwork was all about. Now, the plan was that, you know, of course, Paul has to die, and we'll get to that. So anyway, Helen and Olga went around taking out these policies, several of them, and Helen was mostly the one in charge of all this stuff, but Olga, well, she was very much in on it as well. Helen put herself down as being engaged to Paul, and Olga was listed as a cousin and as a second beneficiary. At the end of the day, these women, Helen and Olga, they were nobody to each other, and they had no reason to be loyal to one another either. And the bottom line was both of these ladies were a couple of shysters. But one of them was a little bit more shady than the other, and that one would be Helen. In a duo, there is always one, or almost always one, who usually takes a leading role, and in this case, it would be Helen. She had long been taking advantage of people. She'd been a proprietor of several rental properties. She'd filed frivolous lawsuits, and just all around, she was just a con woman most of her life. Olga learned her behaviors from her parents and from her upbringing. She followed the lead of her family, and they did what they did out of desperation and to survive. But now in the United States, Olga was following Helen's lead and taking those skills and using them to take advantage of other people. So Helen and Olga did buy some insurance policies together in both of their names on Paul's life. But Helen, behind Olga's back, went and purchased three more policies. And those would be ones that she was not going to have to split the proceeds from with Olga. Now, what these two were doing here with these insurance policies was going to take a lot more time and dedication to carry out the fraud. You really just can't meet someone on the street and then in a week or two, take out millions of dollars in life insurance on that person, and then whoops, out of the blue, they just die suddenly out of nowhere and you get rich. They're going to have to be willing to put in some time because it just doesn't work that way. You have to establish that relationship that they would need to have with Paul, and they would have to do it over the course of 2 years while they waited for those insurance policies to mature. So for those 2 years, Helen and Olga were basically going to have to take complete care of Paul. They were going to have to provide him with a place to live. They were going to have to feed him, clothe him. And I mean, that takes quite some dedication. And in a weird roundabout way, you kind of have to hand it to these ladies. They were willing to put more work in than the average life insurance fraudster, right? Again, like in my last episodes on the Murdochs, I referenced Pam Hupp and how she murdered her quote-unquote best friend, Betsy Faria, for $150,000 in life insurance benefits. And she's also suspected of having killed her own mother, too, in order to collect on her insurance as well. The thing is, Betsy Faria had terminal cancer. She didn't have all that long to live, but good old Pam Hupp just couldn't wait for the cancer to run its course and ended up killing Betsy. And thanks to the help of law enforcement there in that jurisdiction, I don't know who worked the Betsy Faria case, if it was the local police in Troy, Missouri, or if it was Lincoln County, but everybody in that case messed it up. Law enforcement, the prosecutor, investigators, it was like they were helping Pam carry out the murder and the insurance fraud, held her hand along the way, gave her advice, guided her. I still can't believe the crap that happened in that case, and they still insist that Russ Faria is guilty. Crazy, right? But anyway, my point is, unlike Pam Hupp, Helen and Olga were willing to put in the time to make sure that the insurance policies that they purchased would mature and that they would be able to make the claim and that their claims could not be contested. So for the most part, Helen was the one running the show. And the lead detective on the case called her the brains of the operation, a determined, hard-headed, ruthless, and relentless businesswoman. And she fronted most of the money for everything that they were going to need to carry out this insurance scam. She bought all the policies, she paid all the premiums, she paid for Paul's cost of living expenses, she took care of all of his needs, food, clothing, medical, all that stuff. And she did it under the guise of being his quote-unquote nurse, so to speak. And at the time that Helen and Olga got to know Paul, when they first met him, he was 71 years old, and his health was not in good shape. He was pretty frail and needed a lot of help. Since Helen was the money woman, Olga was the one who did most of the work required to take care of him. Every day, she would help him do all of his day-to-day personal care stuff. She would help him get cleaned up. She would help him take a bath. She would cook meals for him. That was kind of her role in this whole thing, just being sort of the caretaker. And because both she and Paul were from Hungary, it enabled Paul to develop a sense of trust in Olga because they were from the same place. 2 years after Paul came to be in the care of Helen and Olga, on November 8, 1999, he was discovered dead in that alleyway in Hollywood, apparently struck by a car. Within a matter of days, Helen and Olga waltzed into the local police station to report Paul missing, and that's when the police were able to link the dead man in the alley to these ladies. Helen identified herself as Paul's fiance, and Olga said she was a long-lost cousin, and with that story, the two of them were able to claim Paul's body, which they quickly buried in an unmarked pauper's grave that Helen had already owned. And from there, the two of them filed their insurance claims. But the insurance companies weren't exactly interested in processing Helen and Olga's claims on Paul's life insurance in a timely manner. The thing was, you know, these little old ladies had spent a good amount of time and money in the planning of this whole thing. These aren't your average, everyday, 70-year-old, grandmotherly type ladies. They were very, very cunning and calculating. They had every last detail planned out, so they were ready for whatever was going to come their way. Neither one of them ever had a worry or a care in the world about what they were doing or who they were hurting, and they were as sure as the day is long that they would be getting away with this because they literally put 2 years of their lives invested into this. The plan not working wasn't even a thing that Helen and Olga entertained. But what they hadn't planned on was the insurance companies dragging their feet when it came to paying out their claims on Paul's life. So some 9, almost 10 months had passed. It was getting into the late summer, early fall of 2000. Helen and Olga had been waiting patiently for the insurance companies to do their thing and process their claims, whatever it is that they do. But still, every day they were checking their mail, waiting for the big payday, and it's just not happening. They haven't got a single penny from the policies that they had purchased on Paul's life. Olga, growing more eager to get her hands on the money, contacted one of the companies that they had purchased the policy from and put in a request to be paid out her half of the claim in advance, but the insurance company denied her request. Helen, in her attempts to grease the wheels with the money, she started writing letters to the insurance carriers threatening to sue them if they didn't get these policies paid out. In fact, Helen started bombarding the insurance companies with threat letters left and right, and the tactic worked, like it usually did in the past, because remember, Helen is a serial lawsuit filer. Within a matter of weeks, Helen and Olga began receiving checks, and in the end, they collected close to $600,000 from the various policies that they had on Paul's life, and they seemed to have gotten away with it, as it appeared that Paul's death was found to have been an accident. For the time being, Helen and Olga had got it made, and they're very much going to be enjoying the fruits of their labor. This major windfall would afford them all the nice things that these ladies feel like they deserved, especially after all the hard work they had put in for nearly 3 years of taking care of Paul and waiting for their claims to be paid out. And for Helen, she became enriched even more. She had a colleague in the real estate business who unexpectedly died shortly after she and Olga collected on Paul's life insurance policies. And Helen immediately jumped all over this dead man's assets by coming up with a document giving herself power of attorney, and then she proceeded to sign over the deeds to 13 of the properties that this man owned, several of them being in very luxurious areas and oceanfront homes in Southern California. I mean, this guy's body was still warm when Helen quit-claimed just about everything that this guy had in his name over into her own name. And his family, and yes, this guy had living relatives and next of kin, they were like, what the hell is going on? But there was little that anyone could do about it because of that power of attorney document. It gave Helen outright control over all of his assets. So with the second sudden windfall that Helen had, and she had no obligation to share with Olga, she took herself on a solo spending spree. She got some cosmetic procedures done, a completely brand new high-end designer wardrobe, and a new Mercedes-Benz. Now, Olga always felt less than and inferior to Helen. I mentioned earlier that in the dynamic of their friendship, if you want to call it a friendship, Helen was the one who had the stronger personality, and she quickly emerged as the boss and the brains of the operation as they carried out their more than a decade-long crime spree at that point. There were often times when Olga felt envious of Helen and how things tended to come to her easily. But really, it was Helen's abrasive and ruthless personality, her manner of issuing threats left and right to get her way. That's what caused things to go her way, and it wasn't necessarily easy. Helen was just a bitch to everybody. And I mean, it's kind of funny and comical sitting here saying that Olga feels slighted and put off by Helen's behavior and her having this big second windfall when they were both clearly doing the wrong thing here. I mean, Olga might have been sitting around feeling sad and jealous and pity for herself when they're carrying out some very serious crimes. It took a lot of nerve for these two old ladies to be going around doing what they were doing, but it was like next level chutzpah for Olga throwing herself this pity party when she was doing some pretty seriously nefarious stuff. Helen lived a glamorous life, while Olga lived in a tiny one-bedroom apartment, and for Olga, this friendship, it was very much steeped in jealousy. So when you live the way Helen and Olga did, especially Helen, There are certain things that are inevitable. One is that nothing lasts forever. And another is too much is never enough, right? There would be a handful of years that would pass until it would come time again for the little old ladies to decide that they needed to come up with their next insurance scam. Even though things went fairly smoothly with the whole scheme involving Paul, Helen and Olga were going to make sure that the second time around, everything was going to go off without a hitch. And at the same time, they also wanted to purchase more insurance policies with even higher payouts. It would only take until around 2002 for Helen and Olga's $600,000 insurance payout on Paul's life to run out. So just about 2 years it took them to blow through all of that money. Not to mention the other windfalls and income that at least Helen had been getting from all those quick claim properties and whatever other scams that she'd been up to with or without Olga. Their relationship was tenuous at best because though they may have had that certain amount of honor among thieves, I guess is what they call it, there's always that nagging feeling that you never really can trust a con artist. The fact was, either one of them can turn on the other at any moment. So they may not trust each other. They may not even really like each other all that much. They each have a very powerful hold over one another that could cost them each their freedom should the other decide to try and pin the blame for all of their criminal activities on each other. It was a very complicated friendship to begin with that only grew increasingly more complex the deeper that these ladies got into their crimes. In September of 2002, that is when Helen and Olga set out to find a new person to lure into their life insurance scam. Confident that they got away with it the first time, so the second time, they decided to go even bigger. And for their next target, they returned to the good old Hollywood Presbyterian Church where they initially found Paul. And mind you, Helen is 72 to 73 years old and Olga is 70 or 71, and they're still at it. They would end up befriending a 50-year-old man named Kenneth McDavid, who I've already told you a little bit about at the beginning of this episode. He grew up in Northern California. I described how he kind of bounced around from job to job and place to place until he kind of sort of just drifted away from work and family altogether and just sort of fell on hard times. Helen and Olga found Kenneth at a time when he was particularly vulnerable and susceptible and very much in need of what they were both offering. And that would be the same things that they had offered to Paul. A roof over his head, food, clothing, medical care. Kenneth jumped at the opportunity and accepted the help that Helen and Olga were offering. After all, nobody means as well as two lovely little old ladies, right? Yeah, they were good at their game. They came off as very genuine and very sincere. One of the things that they did, and I didn't mention this the first time around, is that they went and had a rubber stamp made of Kenneth McDavid's actual signature, and they used that to sign a whole bunch of documents. They did the same thing with Paul Vados' signature. But anyway, they used this rubber stamp of Kenneth's signature to sign a bunch of documents, and initially they took out a total of 6 insurance policies on Kenneth's life. But in the end, they would end up with a total of 13 policies amounting to more than $7 million, which was way more than they had on Paul's life. The investigation that would ultimately come about because of Helen and Olga's funny business with the insurance policies and the related criminal activity would lead them to the company located in Hollywood that, among other things, produces rubber stamps. When this rubber stamp business was contacted by the investigator who was looking into the insurance policies, a representative at the rubber stamp company was like, "Oh yeah, we know those old ladies." And it would be the employees at this rubber stamp place that gave Helen and Olga the nickname the Black Widows. I don't know if they just knew or if they made an assumption, but they weren't exactly far off. But because they had had several rubber stamps made with men's signatures, The inference was that they were doing that for their dead or soon-to-be-dead husbands, for whatever reasons, you know, such as being able to sign documents without these men having to be present or without their knowledge. Like I said, I don't know what the employees at this particular business thought. When they did ask Olga about it, she told them that they needed the stamps for government business. She had come up with some nonsensical story about working for the Los Angeles County Welfare Department, and she assisted these indigent people, and she needed rubber stamps for all of their ongoing endless streams of paperwork. And the rubber stamp company people were like, yeah, okay. So yeah, it was a very prophetic nickname to be given to these ladies, knowing what we know now, the Black Widows. So with rubber stamp in hand, Helen and Olga were ready to do with Kenneth that they had done with Paul. They were going to wait around for the standard 2 years for those policies to mature and for the various insurance companies to be in a position to not be able to contest them. And you know, to keep Kenneth up in an apartment, to feed him, clothe him, take care of him, and to pay all of those insurance policy premiums, Helen and Olga were spending more than $3,000 a month. And when you do the math, that comes to $72,000 for the entire 2 years. It's pretty sad when you think about the place that both Paul and Kenneth had found themselves in with Helen and Olga. Both of these men were under the impression for the entire duration of those 2 years that these ladies were wanting to help them out of the goodness of their hearts. They took care of these men, up to and including their health care needs, without having any idea that in the end it was all going to cost them their lives. It's very rare that any life insurance related murder has had this much planning going on over such a long period of time. I covered a case on Patreon involving a murder for life insurance, and the murderer literally shoved her victim off of a cliff along Pacific Coast Highway in California, like the day after she purchased a policy on her victim's life. When they went in the next day and filed the claim, the insurance agent was like, wait, what? She's dead already? But not Helen and Olga. They took their sweet, sweet time as the insurance agent investigated, the ladies called it. They fattened these men up for the kill. And when it came to Helen and Olga's ever deteriorating relationship, things were really not going great at all. And you know, this whole thing with Kenneth was taking another 2 years, and with each passing month, the contention and animosity between the con grannies grew increasingly worse. In fact, one of the insurance companies based in New York received several phone calls from Helen, who was looking to try to get Olga removed as a second beneficiary, but the insurance company refused to make that type of unilateral change. It was a thing that was going to have to be done by Kenneth McDavid himself, and I don't think the guy had any idea about the millions of dollars that these ladies had taken out on his life. And Helen was not about to let him in on it. So this was the way things were going for Helen and Olga, all the while they were providing shelter, food, and care for their next victim. Helen and Olga wasted no time once the 2 years that they had to sit on those insurance policies was up, and they immediately put their plan into action on June 21st, 2005, a little more than 5 years after Paul Vados was killed. Kenneth was then found dead in an alleyway a few miles away from where Paul was found dead in a very similar manner. Once his body was discovered in the morning, it was pretty clear that Kenneth too had been struck by a vehicle. Another hit and run, and another clean getaway for Helen and Olga, so they thought. I mentioned in the beginning of this episode that it was an officer not minding his own business that overheard some investigators talking about the Kenneth McDavid hit and run when he suddenly remembered that there was a similar death a few years back, and that would be Paul's death. And just like before, these two little old ladies in their 70s had eventually come forward to claim Kenneth's body in order to get the insurance claims moving along. And you know, a few months later, an insurance claims investigator saw some red flags with the policies that Helen and Olga had on Kenneth, and he ended up touching base with the LAPD, the jurisdiction in which Kenneth had died. And before long, the insurance companies, the Los Angeles detectives, and the FBI had formed a task force and started a two-pronged investigation, one involving the insurance fraud and the other involving the murder. And this task force would be dubbed the Granny Task Force. Okay, so in an unplanned move, Dreamers, I decided to go ahead and turn this into a two-parter like I mentioned in the beginning. There are just a lot of interesting details about the investigation into these ladies that I was going to kind of try to rush through in order to squeeze it all into one part and try to get this episode out for you because it's been a minute since I've had an episode. But even good old Keith Morrison did it in 6 parts, so I could at least have the decency to dedicate 2 parts to this story. When we come back for part 2, we are going to pick it up from one of my favorite parts of this whole entire case. When the ladies get bamboozled when it came time to collect on the millions that they had been waiting a long time to get their hands on. The millions of dollars that Kenneth McDavid died for. So I have a good portion of that episode already written. I've just got to make my way through the details of the court documents. And even though I know our favorite Dateline guy, Keith, did a really good job on his series, I think there are a few more details to be had. So I'll be back very soon with the next installment. My daughter is here visiting me as I record, but she's just here kind of vegging out with the doggies while I get this episode out to you. I hope you all had a really fun weekend. It's Sunday night. Keep your eyes on your podcast feeds for the next installment. These crazy old ladies, Golden Girls Gone Wild, the tale of Helen and Olga. I will be back very soon with the final part of this. And until next time, sweet dreams.